Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding.
The truth and lies of America's torture program. The world learns crucial new details as the CIA finally declassifies the essential guide. The Black Banners by an American hero, Ali Soufan. Then,
Donald Trump and other figures like him had succeeded by tapping a wellspring of anxieties, frustrations, and legitimate grievances.
Rock star philosopher Michael Sandel exposes the dark side of meritocracy and the resentment at the heart of that populist wave. And
we were an emerging threat. They definitely didn't see that.
Our Walter Isaacson speaks with Netflix co-founder Reed Hastings about how the upstart streaming service is eating Hollywood's lunch. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The ongoing struggle between the White House and the intelligence community threatens to hamstring America's security on key issues, from foreign election interference to the rise of violent white nationalism. But the conflict began well before Donald Trump's presidency. Indeed, it traces back to the George W. Bush administration, with the politicization of intelligence in the build-up to the Iraq War and the issue of torture and other prohibited practices after 9/11. Former FBI agent Ali Soufan notoriously showed up the torturers, using legal interrogation techniques to uncover crucial facts, including who was the mastermind of the September 11 attacks. He says, quite simply, torture doesn't work. 9 years ago, Soufan's memoir was heavily redacted by the CIA. But now, after a long legal battle, the redactions are finally lifted. And in a new edition called The Black Banners Declassified, Soufan can finally expose the whole truth. And he's joining me now from New York. Ali Soufan, welcome back to the program. Let me just start by asking you to put your thesis and your experience into, you know, current context. We're hearing now today revelations from a new book by Bob Woodward, quoting the president himself and key people around the president, that the president's intelligence higher-ups, his defense chiefs, considered him potentially compromised by foreign powers and, quote, unfit for this particular office. Also, we're hearing that he downplayed the coronavirus to the public while admitting to Bob Woodward on tape that, in fact, it was an incredibly serious and deadly problem. What does this signal to you, particularly in light of what you talk about, which is transparency?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, transparency is extremely important in democracy. You know, we can debate issues. We can debate the war in Iraq, the efficacy of torture. We can debate foreign intervention. But before any of these debates, we need to have a mutual understanding of the truth. And unfortunately, the truth is a very debased currency today in Washington. And that did not just happen under this administration. That's unfortunately, as you correctly mentioned earlier, has been going on for decades. Where is the accountability for the Iraq war or for the claim that Saddam was involved with 9/11? Remember, Christiane, in the eve of the Iraq war, more than 70% of the American public were made to believe that Saddam was connected to the 9/11 attacks, or to WMD, or he's working with bin Laden to develop a WMD that might have a mushroom cloud over the United States, as, you know, we've been told, and as actually Secretary Powell told the UN Security Council at the time, based on the intelligence that they gave him. So what is the accountability for that? We never had accountability. We never have transparency. Anyone who agree with what the governments want, they can say whatever they want. And anyone who disagree, they might classify them. That's exactly what happened with the Black Banner. I was not allowed to say that torture did not work. And I was not allowed to say how we actually got information that was later claimed it was the result of torture and waterboarding. And today, for the first time, the world and the American public can have a front seat in the interrogation rooms when we were getting all this information, and they can make up their mind about the efficacy of torture or if this was the right thing to do or not. And hopefully that can bring transparency back, bring facts back.
Ali Soufan, you know, I said in the introduction to you that, you know, you and your interrogation methods revealed crucial facts about 9/11, revealed who the mastermind was, revealed what some of those, you know, accused 9/11 conspirators were doing and when they were doing it and how they were doing it and the whole conspiracy. Tell me, what is the most important reveal for you that the public should know now that those acres and acres of black bars have been removed, those redactions have been removed from your text and from your account?
Wow, a lot. I'm sure you and many of your listeners remember the dirty bomb, the so-called dirty bomb, and how it was the result of enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding. And now you will see how we get the information that led us to the arrest of Jose Padilla, the accused dirty bomber. It has nothing to do with torture. It has nothing to do with waterboarding. Information that the public heard about in the aftermath of 9/11, plots in New York, plots in LA, disruption of terror cells in Southeast Asia. All these, you know, plots were claimed to be stopped because of torture. And none of this information came because of torture. The identification of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, also known as KSM, as the master of 9/11, it happened when I showed Abu Zubaydah, a suspected terrorist, the wrong photo. And I said, is this the guy that you're telling me about? And he looked at me and he said, no, this is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. This is Mukhtar. He called him by his Qaeda name. This is Mukhtar. This is a mastermind of the plane operations. That's how we got the information. And it was so disheartening to see some of these plots being exaggerated and then later being claimed to be the result of a program that was a total failure. Now the American people and the world can read the truth.
So explain then, what was the failure of the so-called enhanced interrogation, which many have called torture? What was the failure of that compared to what you talk about, which is rapport building and the ability to get information like that? Because the CIA and you, being in the FBI, you were at loggerheads a lot over your differences with the methods. So tell me about how they did it, how you did it, and how you got that information from Abu Zubaydah.
Yeah, first of all, it wasn't CIA after FBI. Many of the CIA colleagues that I had with me in the field agreed totally with what's going on. They actually complained to their inspector general, and that's why they did a very thorough review of the program that actually found out that it did not work. So the thing with torture, it gives you compliance. It doesn't give you cooperation. When you're doing an interrogation, you want the truth. You don't want somebody to tell you what they think you want to hear because they want the torture to stop. I'll give you an example of compliance. A terrorist by the name of Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, who was working with Al-Qaeda, he was caught, was taken to a third country, was tortured. And under torture, he gave information that linked Saddam Hussein to bin Laden to WMD. That information made it to Secretary Powell's speech at the UN, naming him as the source of the information. After we went to Iraq and we found out, first, there is no WMD. Second, there is no cooperation between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. They went back to Ibn Sheikh and they said, why did you lie? And he said, well, I wanted the torture to stop, so I told you what you wanted to hear. Now imagine that. That is compliance. Cooperation is getting the facts, getting information that can lead you to stop a terror plot, not a lie that can probably send you going around the world looking for ghosts. This is a big difference between compliance and between cooperation. Another thing, we fight for our values. We took an oath to protect these values and to protect our Constitution. And torture is against what we stand for. And when we do it, we actually diminish our credibility in the world. More people joined Al-Qaeda in Iraq and joined the insurgency in Iraq because of the photos from Abu Ghraib than the statements and the speeches of Osama bin Laden. So torture.
And those, of course, we remember were the with the terrible photos of people being, you know, humiliated. They were naked. They had so-called electrodes, pretend electrodes attached to them. So we know that that was a really dark chapter. I want to ask you, because the CIA itself knows and knew even prior to 2001 that torture didn't yield results. The 2014 Senate Intelligence Committee report said, prior to the attacks of 2001, the CIA itself determined from its own experience with coercive interrogations that such techniques do not produce intelligence, will probably result in false answers, and had historically proven to be ineffective. Yet these conclusions were ignored. I'm going to ask you why you think they were ignored, but also, having redacted your account, they then looked at it again, and the CIA itself says that there was no violation or risk to national security by what you were writing in your book, that it had no need to have been redacted 9 years ago.
Yeah, and this is really interesting. I mean, this is probably why so many CIA officers, men and women, colleagues, who were with me in the field, disagreed with this experimentation by the contractors. And they complained, and they continued to complain back to headquarters about what they were seeing. And today, the reader can see that very clearly in the Black Banner. So it was not as some people in the agency at the time tried to make it, FBI versus CIA. Second, I am very grateful to the current leadership of the CIA for unredacting the Black Banners, for practicing this act of institutional transparency that made the people in the United States and around the world know the truth about this program. So hopefully, when somebody like President Trump says he's going to bring waterboarding and worse than waterboarding, hopefully when somebody said something like this in the future, the American voters and the American public will be more skeptic.
Can I ask you also, in terms of long-term results of torture and other prohibited practices, what does it mean? I mean, for instance, Guantanamo Bay Prison still has people in there, and they are not, you know, they're not angels. These are people who probably have blood on their hands, but have not yet been tried. And I wonder whether there's a problem with the evidence because some of it was achieved under torture. I mean, can these people actually be prosecuted?
Absolutely not. I mean, with everything that's going on, you've seen Khalid Sheikh Mohammed murdered more than 3,000 Americans, murdered innocent people. And this is only if you want to, you know, focus on what he did during 9/11. And we cannot even prosecute him. We cannot even put him in jail and give him the justice that his victims deserve. So this is another problem with torture. This is another problem that when we have a system and a set of laws based on our values, on our democratic values, and we do things that contradict these values, we gonna end up with total failure. And this is one of the issues that we're seeing today in Guantanamo Bay, the direct result of that failure.
Ali Soufan, there is a disinformation campaign against you right now. And there are many, and I think you yourself say that it's coming from Saudi Arabia. And there are fears that it's from the same quarters that launched the initial disinformation campaign against our friend Jamal Khashoggi before he ended up murdered and dismembered. Now, obviously, the Saudi authorities completely deny any interference with what's happening in your case. What is going on as far as you know? Why are you under this threat? Are you afraid for your life?
Well, in early May, I was told by the U.S. government that I am being targeted by a terrorist organization. A few days later, we start to experience a highly coordinated disinformation campaign against me that include threats and intimidations and so forth. So my colleagues in our firm, we do disinformation. They decided to investigate it. And we found out that this, even though it contained similar terminology and the threat was briefed by the U.S. government, but this one specifically can be connected to folks in Saudi Arabia and even to the Saudi government. During our investigation, we found forensic evidence that shows striking similarities between the campaign that I'm going, the campaign against me and what happened with Jamal Khashoggi, to include the same individuals, the same accounts, sometimes the same bots. Many of these bots and accounts that participated in such attacks, more than 5,000 of them were stopped by Twitter. And Twitter basically said that they were directly connected to an influence operations by the Saudi government. We're still looking into this. We shared a lot of the information with the U.S. government, and the U.S. government is also looking into both the threat and the influence operation. I have full trust with my former colleagues in the FBI and in the agency and other U.S. intelligence agencies, and I believe that they are good in watching my back.
Well, let's hope so. Let me ask you one final question, and it's really, to me, quite stunning. You wrote recently an op-ed, actually just before lockdown, in the New York Times. It was titled, "We Once Fought Jihadists, Now We Battle White Supremacists." You say white supremacists today are organized in a similar fashion to jihadist terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda in the 1980s and 90s. They transcend national barriers with recruitment and dissemination of propaganda. This is quite extraordinary. Tell me about that. I mean, are these potential, what we're seeing, who are these groups that you're talking about? Should they be classified as terrorists? Describe what's going on.
They are not monolithic, but there is something in common against among them. Racist, neo-Nazi, Islamophobe, they call themselves ultranationalists in some cases. They are based in many Western societies, and they are behaving exactly like the jihadis behaved in the past. And now I believe they are in the same level, as I testified in Congress, where the jihadis and Al-Qaeda were in the early 90s. They recruit in a similar manner. They even have a place where they can build relationships, expand their global network, train, have combat experience. The jihadis had that place, if you remember, Christian, and it's Afghanistan. You know, the white supremacists, they have it in Ukraine. We started to see this global network interact with each other on an operational level. And many countries in the Western world are taking that threat very seriously. Frankly, even the Trump administration, in the national security strategy, they referenced white supremacist organizations as a threat to the national security of the United States. So what's going today is we're trying to raise awareness and help people in the field have the legal tools at their fingertips in order to stop these organizations. In the United States, unfortunately, we do not have domestic terrorism laws. It's extremely difficult to prosecute or arrest anyone on the ground of domestic terrorism, unlike international terrorism, where we can use a lot of laws and tools to include material support to stop an individual. For example, if you're going to conduct a terrorist attack and you get stopped before you conduct the terrorist attack and you're a white supremacist, you can claim everything you said before is protected by the First Amendment. The fact that you have gun when you get arrested, that are protected by the Second Amendment. And most probably, you will be released by a judge. In international terrorism, because of material support, that is not going to happen. So we're trying to raise awareness, and we're trying to help law enforcement and intelligence agencies to have the tools that they need in order to be as effective against the white supremacist threat as we are against the jihadis.
Yeah, and indeed it needs vigilance because, as you say, the U.S. says it's a lethal threat that could persist for the next several years. Ali Soufan, thank you so much indeed. Now, politicizing intelligence, like undermining the press and ignoring scientific experts, are all hallmarks of the wave of recent populism, from the Philippines to Britain, Latin America, and the United States. How was an elite Oxbridge graduate able to portray himself as Brexit's man of the people? And how was a New York billionaire able to sell himself as the scourge of the elites? My next guest, the celebrated philosopher Michael Sandel, says people like Johnson and Trump tap into deep-seated grievances against the so-called best and the brightest. Sandel argues that the ruling class in politics, in business, and even at his home base at elite institutions like Harvard, weaponized meritocracy to lock in their status and devalue essential contributions of the working class. So, can our winner-take-all system be reformed before it's too late? Michael Sandel joins me now from Massachusetts. Welcome to the program. Let me ask you, do you think that's a fair description? I mean, that, you know, weaponizing that sort of that experience to lock in people's, you know, privilege and status right now.
I do think that in recent decades, in addition to the growing inequality that we've seen, there's been a tendency of those who landed on top to believe that they deserve their success, that they've made it on their own, and by implication, that those who haven't flourished, those who are less credentialed than they, must deserve their fate as well. And this is, I think, contributed to the galling sense among many working people in democratic societies that elites look down on them. And I think we need to make sense of this sense of resentment and attend to it if we're going to manage to stave off the wave of authoritarian populism that we're seeing in the US, in Britain, and in many parts of the world.
So your book, of course, is The Tyranny of Merit. And it almost sounds a little bit counterintuitive. If you're me sitting in, you know, class-ridden Britain, you look at the United Right. States and you think, wow, it's not about class there, it's about merit. And if you try hard, you can succeed. But you're saying that now is a false narrative, that class is one thing, but also meritocracy is not what it used to be. Tell me how you analyze the reality in that regard.
Right. There are two problems, Christiane. One of them is that we don't live up to the meritocratic principles we profess at Ivy League universities in the U.S., for example, despite generous financial assistance for students from poor families. Still, there are more students in these places from the top 1% than from the entire bottom half of the country combined. So the opportunity to rise, individual mobility, which is one of the great promises of the American dream that has attracted people around the world, doesn't quite fit the facts on the ground. It's harder to rise in the US and in Britain than in many other places, many European countries, than in Canada. That's one problem. But there's a deeper problem, which is the meritocratic ideal that if you work hard, you can rise, you can overcome the inequality we've experienced in recent decades through individual mobility. That ideal is flawed, at least so I try to argue in the book. It's corrosive of the common good because it leads the successful, those who land on top, to believe that their success is their own doing and that they therefore deserve the bounty the market bestows on them, and by implication, that those on the bottom must deserve their fate as well. And this set of attitudes, these attitudes towards success that have accompanied the growing inequality of recent decades, this, I think, accounts for the deep resentments and anger and sense of grievance by many working people who have fueled the populist authoritarian backlash against mainstream parties and governing elites.
It's almost like you're saying one of the key issues here is that, you know, there is this dark side. You know, if you don't make it in America, it must be your fault. Whereas, you know, in a aristocratic class society, it's just that's the way it is. And maybe people can rationalize it like that. So it's about, I think, dignity, right? It's about self-worth and dignity. And we hear, you know, like books like Deaths of Despair talk about the terrible consequence of a lack of dignity. Right. Do you think that's what's happened, the loss of dignity?
Yes, I think the loss of dignity is right at the center of this, Christiane. And what's happened is, as these attitudes towards success and failure have taken hold, the divide between winners and so-called losers has deepened, polarizing our societies, driving us apart. And a great many working people, especially those who don't have a four-year university degree, feel that the work they do is no longer respected. It's no longer a source of social recognition and esteem. So what I propose in the book is to shift from responding to inequality through the promise of individual upward mobility through getting a university degree, which leaves out over half of our population, shifting instead to a politics centered on the dignity of work, asking ourselves, not how can we arm people for meritocratic competition and combat, but how can we make life better for people who may not have a four-year university degree, but who nonetheless make valuable contributions through the work they do, the service to their communities, the families they raise. So shifting our political emphasis toward making life better and making work dignified for people who contribute in important ways, regardless of how well-credentialed they may be.
I'm going to get to that in a second. Actually, now I'll get to it because you just brought it up. I think you say credentialism is the last remaining, you know, acceptable prejudice. Tell me what you mean.
Right. Well, credentialism has been fueled by what seems to be an inspiring political project. And it's important to recognize the appeal, the allure of the meritocratic political project that says, if you want to compete and win in the global economy, get a university degree from a brand name university if you can, because the new economy will reward you. Now, there's an insult implicit in that seemingly inspiring promise. And the insult is this: if you don't go to college, if you don't have a university degree, and if you're struggling in the new economy, your failure must be your fault, because you haven't acquired the credentials that this new economy requires, not only for material success, but also for esteem, for recognition, for honor. In many ways, the political crisis we face with Trump, mm-hmm. with authoritarian populists who appeal to these grievances, the political crisis is a crisis about a sense of humiliation, a sense of a great many people that they are being looked down upon. Not only that their wages have stagnated, but that the work they do is no longer valued. And unless Democratic politicians in the U.S., center-left political parties generally in the U.K. and Europe, unless they find a way to address this sense of resentment among working people, they will not be able, I'm afraid, to succeed in beating back the appeal of the authoritarian populist figures who speak directly to that sense of grievance, humiliation, and resentment.
Okay, so there are two points there that I want to ask you about. One, the current Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, is one of the rare right. presidential candidates without an Ivy League degree. He's been right. known for a long time, I think, as a man of the people. The other thing is, what about these strong men populists, and they all are strong men populists, who have said they hear the pain of the people, but have not delivered. What, right. I mean, is there sort of a, you know, a cognitive dissonance then?
Well, there is an enormous gap, just as you say, Christiane, between the political appeal of these so-called strong men, populists, their appeal to working people, and what they actually deliver. As we've seen with the Trump administration, most of his policies don't help the people he appeals to and who are the base of his support. Beyond pointing out the hypocrisy in that, though, we have to figure out why. How can he nonetheless retain the support of people for whom he does not provide policies that serve their interests? Why is that? And I think it's a pretty urgent matter for us to figure that out. There must be another source of appeal that he has, or perhaps more to the point, a source of aversion to the center-left alternatives. And I think it's the second. You mentioned that Joe Biden does not come from an Ivy League university. In fact, he's the first Democratic nominee in 36 years not to have an Ivy League degree. This in itself should tell us something about the way in which over the past four decades, those who govern, whether at the level of the presidency or in Congress and in the parliaments of Britain and Europe, increasingly have become dominated by those with university degrees. And the effect of this is that relatively few working people any longer participate in representative government. There's been a sharp decline over the past 40 or 50 years. And this, too, I think, is a consequence of the credentialism. I refer to it as a kind of meritocratic hubris among the successful, mm-hmm. that their lustrous credentials give them a sense of desert for reaping the rewards that the market bestows on them. Whereas over half of their fellow citizens lack those university qualifications and credentials. And in effect, they've not only has the dignity of their work been called in question, but so has their access to representative government.
So let me ask you this finally then. Look, you're talking about the credential of the head, you know, the sort of, you know, the knowledge economy versus the hands and the heart and working class. But do you think sometimes moments in history can shift this dynamic? For instance, for the last 6 months, we have all around the world been clapping those working class people, those essential workers who are either in the grocery stores or driving the delivery trucks or the ambulances or the nurses and all of those. Those have become the people who we admire the most and respect the most these days. Do you see that that has a potential to shift this dynamic?
Yes, I think this is a moment. This time of pandemic crisis is a moment that could be a point of turning in just this respect. Because we recognize, those of us who work from home and hold meetings on Zoom, we recognize, finally, our deep dependence on workers we often overlook. I'm not just thinking of people who work in the hospitals caring for COVID patients. But the delivery workers, the warehouse workers, the grocery store clerks, the home health care providers, the child care workers, these are not the best paid or the most honored members of our economy or society. And yet now we realize, we call them key workers or essential workers, we recognize our mutual dependence in ways that we easily overlooked before this moment. So my hope is that this can be a time for a new public debate about the dignity of work, about how to bring about a better alignment between the rewards, the material rewards, but also the social recognition and esteem we accord people on whom we depend, bring that into better alignment with the importance of the work they do, highly credentialed or not.
As you put it in the subtitle to your book, The Common Good, essentially. Professor Sandel, thank you so much indeed for joining us on this vital topic. Thank you so much. And now, if you've been binge-watching your way through this pandemic, you are not alone. Business is booming for Netflix, which added a whopping 10 million users in this year's second quarter. Our next guest, Reed Hastings, is the co-founder and co-CEO of Netflix. He says the secret of their success is a smash-the-conventions culture, and he's written about it in a new book called No Rules Rules. Here he is talking to our Walter Isaacson about that and about why he's not worried about young people becoming video addicts.
Thank you, Christian and Reed. Welcome to the show.
A real treat, Walter. Thank you.
You've just come out with a book called No Rules Rules. It's based on a slideshow you once did on a reinvention, how to create a culture of reinvention. Part of it is only having A players, as Steve Jobs would say. Explain that to me.
Well, the book is really about employee freedom. More than most companies, we try to create a climate where employees can make decisions, including impactful big decisions. And it's a whole system around how do you have great employee freedom, no rules, and not have chaos? Because the benefit is that you get great flexibility and adaptation. Now, you asked about how do you have great players hiring A players. Everyone tries to hire A players. That's pretty consistent across many companies. What they don't do or do unevenly is let people go. And what we say is we're a team, like a professional sports team, not like a family. We want great players in every position because that's the only way we have a chance of winning the championship, of pleasing our members around the world with incredible entertainment.
You say that there should be no rules so that people can flourish, set their own rules and do their things. What happens during a pandemic where people aren't coming into the office? Is that a problem?
It's worked as well as it can. It's not as good as being together in person. But our employees have sacrificed tremendously to do their work. It's been so hard for those who live alone or those who have young kids at home. And they've really leaned in. But like everyone, I can't wait till this COVID thing is done.
How has the coronavirus pandemic affected Netflix's way of doing business?
You know, we're doing all the things that everyone else is doing, is living on video conferences and getting through it. But the big thing is when people are locked up at home, you know, they really need great entertainment. They want escape. And so we've been very fortunate to grow. In the first half of the year, we grew from about 170 to about 195 million households subscribing to Netflix. So we've been very fortunate, like Home Depot or Amazon, that in this crisis, our business has increased.
You've talked about competition. Who is your real competition and what sideways threats, to use a phrase in your book, you worried about?
You know, what we've really talked about internally with our employees is we're really good executing on the current business. And, you know, Disney Plus is also really good, or Disney. And, you know, we'll both do really well as we have great models. But the dangerous threats are often the subtle substitutes. Say that TikTok continues growing for 5 or 10 years, or YouTube, and that they do more and more professional-like entertainment. Or video gaming companies do more longer form where there's real story in there and, you know, become very compelling. So we can be outcompeted by non-premium entertainment companies just as well as we can be outcompeted by premium entertainment.
How did you and Ted Sarandos, co-CEO, decide at some point you were going to be a content business?
Well, we've always been an entertainment business right from the beginning, and we started on DVD by mail. And what our book shows is how you can evolve. Our particular evolution was DVD to streaming, but every business faces that. If you really invest in the openness and the flexibility of culture. I mean, Blockbuster was actually a very well-run company that was the best in the world at video stores. And then they just couldn't, you know, make the leap to going into streaming. So this can happen to almost any company. And what the book really illustrates is you want to be preparing for that long in advance.
And tell us about that somewhat famous meeting you had with the Blockbuster CEO, and what did you learn from that meeting?
What I learned is how hard it is to see emerging threats. We were an emerging threat. They definitely didn't see that, and it was only 10 years later when they were bankrupt and we were grown that everyone else could see it.
And I think it was one of my former bosses, Jeff Bukas, said something that, you know, he wasn't going to worry about you. You were like the Albanian army. Were there a lot of people who didn't see the threats?
Yeah, and in Jeff Bukas' case, it's most interesting because very sophisticated guy, very thoughtful. And he was the one with the AOL Time Warner merger that had been against it. He was the one that saved the company afterwards because he saw correctly at that time that the internet was bunk. But what happens is, yes, it was at that time in the year 2000, but 20 years later, the internet is really capable of television. So sometimes you overlearn one lesson that 10 years later, there's a different answer to.
You've recently gotten more into nonfiction as well. Was that something that surprised you that it turned out to be a good line of work?
I mean, Tiger King, The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, we did with ESPN. There's so many great nonfiction stories. Indian Matchmaking, another amazing one. So, no, we always thought we would expand into that, just as we have into stand-up comedy, frankly, into film, because we started on original series only. So, you know, we're now covering the gamut. And one of the big challenges ahead is, can we get better than Disney at family animation? So, you know, they've had 100 years. That's their core. And for us to, you know, get better than them, we hope over 5 or 10 years will be quite a challenge. But those are the kind of ambitious challenges that we love.
When you look at the differences, experiences, and you try to make people come together, sometimes the cultures are so divisive or so different. And you've had to make some accommodations, especially in Saudi Arabia at one point on a comedy series. To what extent do you want to make those accommodations to make sure everybody can be in the tent with you? And to what extent do you want to make sure you're sharing visions?
It's really extraordinary around the world, the content that we're able to carry. Broadcast television in most countries around the world is highly regulated and quite constrained. And we've got shows like Queer Eye and Sex Education and Orange is the New Black on our service in Indonesia, in Saudi Arabia, all over the world. So when you're dealing in fiction, you really get license to explore, again, different worlds. And that's what really helps people grow and connect.
What's coming up with the deal that you have with Barack Obama?
We have an overall production deal with Barack and Michelle Obama, and you saw Michelle's documentary Becoming. Their film American Factory won an Oscar last year. So we've seen lots of great work from them. Again, not political, really, human interest. We just did another big deal with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. And same kind of thing. We want to do broadly entertaining things that really bring people together to see a new story.
You've moved some of your money into Black-owned banks. And I know you're friends with Bill Bynum. You've worked with him through the Aspen Institute and other places. To what extent do you see corporations having a role to play in this period where we're wrestling with civil rights in order to say, here's where we stand?
Well, in the United States, we have a tremendous gap between average Black family wealth and average white family wealth, about a tenfold gap. And part of that is legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and many other things. And black banks, because they black bank businesses and families, don't have as much money. And so by putting 1 or 2% of every company's assets, depositing them in black banks, we increase the capital in black banks, which increases the lending, which grows the economy, and we can start to close the wealth gap between black and white families. And when you close the wealth gap, you start to close the power gap.
And how might you be doing that with your product from Netflix?
You know, our product is really for entertainment. So we have Black AF from Kenya Barris. And, you know, it's a hilarious, but also sort of social commentary title. Or we have 13th by Ava DuVernay about the history of mass incarceration. So we have a broad range of content, but our fundamental aspect as Netflix is to be incredibly entertaining.
One of the things I've known about you that's probably not as well known is how you deeply study values. You love these seminars and ways of discussing values with people. To what extent have your values influenced the type of things you do, both in business and in the content you create?
Well, I think having a clear sense of your own values and your firm's values are really important. And with our employees, we've developed clarity around that, about what we want to represent to consumers and what we don't. We're not in sports, even though sports is very enjoyable. We're not in video games, even though that's very enjoyable. We're not in news, even though that's very important. So we're really focused on series and films and trying to be the absolute best in the world at it, and then to grow to be able to entertain the whole world. That would be such an accomplishment.
And one of those things that you said at one point that you weren't into was that it wasn't your role to be telling truth to power. Was that a little bit of an overstatement, and have you rethought that?
Well, one version of truth to power is that's when you have real journalists, you know, that sometimes go to jail, sometimes are killed. Journalism's a super serious business. So what we do is certainly there's truth in all entertainment, and there's aspects of truth to power, but I don't want to pretend that what we do is as dangerous or as important as journalism.
One of the rules that you have in your great new book involves humility, which is that you should never crow about any success you may have had, and you also, when you make mistakes, you should be upfront and talk about those. To what extent have you talked openly about certain mistakes you've made?
Well, within the company, we're very big on that, of sharing things that could be better, not for the purpose of humiliation or, you know, something negative, but from the sense of learning and growth. We learn the most when people give us feedback. And the funny thing is, even for me, with all this success, when someone gives me negative feedback, it still hurts. And then I try to remember, oh, it's like doing crunches or push-ups. And I know those last ones hurt, but those are the ones that make you strong. And it's the same thing with feedback. And so I'm better now at just absorbing the feedback, feeling the pain still, but recognizing that's what makes me better.
You write in your book about your wonderful mother and the family you grew up in. But being in a household in which emotions weren't really discussed that much. And then you talk about your early marriage and being in couples training. To what extent has that informed the way you operate and the way you wrote these rules for Netflix?
Growing up, I was a typical, restrained family, or maybe that was just my orientation. And I write in the book that I learned a lot about honesty from our marriage counselor, which he really helped me see that I was systematically lying. I would say things like, you know, family's the most important thing. And then I would stay at work late at night. And he helped me to see that this was, bad for me, and I should really learn to be very honest and self-reflective and self-aware. And that has helped tremendously in my marriage, and we just celebrated our 29th wedding anniversary. But surprisingly, it's also helped a lot at Netflix. And as a leader, I realize if I can set a good example of being honest and open and curious, then we'll attract people like that. And then the whole company can grow, as we have from DVD by mail to streaming to original content.
You were a longtime board member at Facebook. You're friends with Sheryl Sandberg and to some extent Mark Zuckerberg. Do you ever talk to them about the values you adhere to and how Facebook might in some ways, either intentionally or unintentionally, be undermining some of those values?
Well, Mark and Sheryl take their responsibilities very seriously, and they're definitely wrestling with the effects in society. And every new technology that's important, you know, has downsides. And they and the society, Twitter, YouTube, all the user-generated TikTok, you know, are wrestling with how do you mostly be for the good and mitigate the bad.
But the algorithms you build into, you know, your system help people connect with the entertainment they like the most. The algorithms at a place like Facebook tend to reinforce and in times inflame or enrage people. Do you think it's not just a small problem, but a systemic flaw in the way some of these social media sites are built?
You know, it's a challenge that they have, and really they're the ones you should probably ask about that, because we get the joy of just focusing on our members and sort of, in some sense, an easier problem, which is how do you give people great entertainment that they're going to rave about?
And how much do you worry about the amount of time, especially young people these days, are spending online and how the algorithms for all types of online things tend to be addictive in a way?
You know, when you think about the roots of television and the beginning of TV, people used to say in the 1960s, oh, TV is awful, it's going to wreck society. That didn't happen. Before that, it was rock and roll was going to wreck society. So I have a lot of confidence that youth will learn how to adapt and become digital natives, and all of these things will be channeled to the positive.
What rules did you have for your kids?
You know, the book that we are launching today is called No Rules Rules. So you can guess I'm not a big person for rules. I'm a big person for principles and, you know, understanding and experiences. So we had very few, I can't think of any rules for our kids, but they did grow up, you know, 15 years ago. So it was an easier time than today.
Reed, thanks so much for joining us.
Walter, what a pleasure.
Fascinating conversation. And finally tonight, from sports to the big screen, the times, they are indeed a-changing. At the U.S. Open, tennis champion Naomi Osaka is turning the center court into a protest space, her face mask bearing the names of victims who've triggered the protests against racial injustice, people like Ahmaud Arbery, Trayvon Martin, and Breonna Taylor. And their families are grateful. Listen up.
Naomi, I just want to tell you thank you for the support of my family. And God bless you with what you're doing and you're supporting our family with my son.
We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Continue to do well. Continue to kick butt at the U.S. Open.
Later, Osaka told reporters those messages almost overwhelmed her.
I was just trying really hard not to cry, but for me it's a bit surreal, and it's extremely touching that, you know, they would feel touched by what I'm doing. For me, I feel like what I'm doing is nothing. It's a speck of what I could be doing.
And what she is going to be doing is playing in the semifinals on Thursday at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center out there in New York. Meantime, over in La La Land, the Oscars are announcing that they'll only consider movies for Best Picture if they pass four new diversity standards. They will come into force in 2024. And the new goals will try to give a boost to underrepresented groups on screen and behind the camera, all building on a diversity push that began under the Academy's former president, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, who took the 2015 hashtag protest, OscarsSoWhite, seriously. Join us tomorrow for my interview with superstar Chinese pianist Lang Lang. He gives us our own mini concert all the way from Beijing. And we're going to leave you now with a little preview of that. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London. Thank you.
now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.